This episode of The Last Video Store is brought to you by Tropfest. It's happening on Sunday the 22nd of February at Centennial Park, and I will be there, as will you. Welcome to an episode of The Last Video Store, the show where I, Alexi Toliopoulos, talk to cool, funny, interesting people about their favorite films in the style of an old school video store rental combo, which includes a staff pick recommendation from my big old movie brain based on the taste of our guests. And our guests on this episode, dare I say, could not be more freaking pumped to have guests on this show than ever before. Two ultimate heroes of mine when it comes to cinematic comedy. We've got Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll, the creators, the stars of Nirvana, the band, the show, and especially for this episode, a little movie called Nirvana, the show. Called Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. And I loved this film. We get into it straight away with Jay and Matt, but I could not be bigger fans of these guys. The TV show Nirvana, the band, the show is just, I think, one of the greatest comedy TV shows of all time. And I've been a big fan of Matty Johnson. The Dirties is one of my favorite movies. Operation Avalanche, Blackberry, all films that Jay also provided the score for, I think are just, I don't know, I found them really inspirational as someone wanting to make big screen and interesting comedy work. I cannot speak highly enough of them, and I genuinely could not believe that I could get them for this show, and especially to have a pretty decent length chat with them. But what really excites me, rather than just talking to them about the movie, is talking to them about the Australian influences that they have. Shout outs to Auntie Donna and Chris Lilly on this episode, but also a little down the line towards the end of the episode, which I would say is maybe the most exciting minutes we've ever had on this podcast, is the great Matt Johnson going on an impassioned rant about his love and appreciation of Australian cinema. Honestly, it made me emotional in the moment to hear someone from across the seas over in Canada really talk with such eloquence and such passion and excitement about the cinema that I hold most dear to me, which is Australian cinema. We have some great talks about Australian film on this. They both pick Aussie movies to talk about, and we get pretty sticky talking about like the process of making something like Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. So if you've ever been curious about how they have those interactions with real life people out on the street and how they work and how they go down and what inspired them to do such things, that is a big bulk of the conversation that we have. And I'm going to give a plug for their movie. Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie is screening in Australia one weekend only this weekend, February 20th and February 21st. I saw this film at the screening that happened at South by Southwest Sydney. It was one of the great screenings I've ever been to. And I just cannot tell you how great this movie plays with the crowd. And if you love these guys, if you'd never heard of these guys before, whatever it is, go see this in the cinema. I'm going to actually say, producer Dave, I'm looking at you right now. I know that we're running out of time for this intro, but I'm going to say every cinema that this is playing with in Australia this weekend. In New South Wales, we're at Dendy Newtown, the Hayden Orpheum Picture Palace, Palace Central, Ritz Cinemas, Tower Cinemas Newcastle in Victoria, Brunswick Picture House, Cinema Nova, Classic Cinema, Lido Cinema, Palace Pentridge, Queensland is at Disney Cooperoo, Palace James Street, South Australia is at Palace Nova Eastland. WA is at Luna Leaderville, great cinema. ACT is Dendy Canberra. And Tasmania, it is at the State Cinema, which I just visited. I love the State Cinema. So if you are in any of those towns, go see this. Take all your freaking mates. Go see this film this weekend. I am likely going to go to at least one screening of it this weekend. Might go to two. Who knows? I would say definitely go, make time for it. It's so fun, great film. Before we get into the episode, one quick plug. My show, VHS, is starting very soon at the Adelaide Fringe Festival, March 10th, on for about a week onwards from that. Then I'm at Melbourne Comedy Festival, Sydney Comedy Festival, Brisbane Comedy Festival has just been announced, I think. The tickets are all in the show notes. Sydney's almost sold out. Melbourne is really selling fast. Adelaide, not so well just yet. It's doing okay, but please, if you're in Adelaide, buy tickets because I really want you to see this show and you're the first people to freaking see it. So I'll see you there. If you love this episode, if you love me talking about movies, I would say VHS is maybe the funniest version of me talking about movies I've ever planned. So let's get there. Until next time, love your babies. See you at the end of the episode.
Talking.
Here we go. How are we, guys?
We're good. You're a real movie guy. I love this.
Oh, you bet. I'm true blue, one of the greatest movie guys.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, I'm happy you got to see the film. I imagine that there was a lot in there for you.
Oh, absolutely. I've been a big fan of you guys from, you know, the start. And I got to see the film at South by Southwest Sydney last year. So it was great to see it with a crowd and then, you know, rewatch it again this week too.
How was the crowd at South by Sydney?
Oh, it was unbelievable. Like, you could not have asked for a better reaction, really. Like, people still talk about that screening. Like, it went really, really well.
Amazing.
I'm happy to hear that.
Lovely.
We tried to really front load it with as much, like, Australian inside jokes as we could in this intro that we shot.
Yeah, I remember you talked about my good friend's Auntie Donna, and you also, I want to ask you about it. You talked about Chris Lilley being a bit of like a North Star for like early creative work. Tell me about that?
I was working as a tour guide at the Ontario Science Centre, and a girl named Vanessa Calder or Caldwell, I don't remember exactly, handed me a USB drive, and she said, "You're really going to like this." I didn't even know her that well. And she handed me this drive, and it was the entire series of Summer High Tide. And I think Jay and I watched the pilot of that series. Oh, you know what? I'm not sure how many times we watched it together, but I have watched the first episode of that show probably 20 or 25 times.
Wow.
I couldn't believe what he was doing.
The drama teacher in his office talking about how he's there for the children, and it's really just about the children for me. I mean, you could say it's, and then a student opens up the door and he just turns his head a bit, get out. That's one of the best jokes I've ever seen in my life. The way that
we quote it all the time. It makes us seem like, what's the term you use? Boggin?
Yeah. Bogan. Bogan.
Bogan. It makes us maybe seem a bit bogan, but, like that show, for real, like we're so young, it like changed our lives. I think about it every day. I think this guy is a genius. I don't know how he did what he did. It was the most flawed. And remember, like we saw that and we're like, oh, we'll never be going to be able to do this because it's like he's integrating real people into the script of his stuff. Like those aren't real people. They're real people acting as themselves. And the performance he's getting out of the guidance counselor who's dealing with Jonah Takalua. I've never seen a performance like that in my life. When he's like, "Jonah, he said that you were the ringleader who threw his bag over the tracks." Like everything he said, I'm like, what? I've never seen an actor, even a trained actor, be able to do this. The mean teacher, the female principal, like they're... Every single performance in that show, the skunk-haired Polynesian kid who at the end when they realize that Jonah was the one who graffitied all the cars and they see the principal walking towards him, the guy goes, "Oh, they've worked it out." Jonah, they've worked it out. Like, how did you do that? I don't know. To this day, I don't know how that was created. I've never seen anything else like it. Even in Lily's own other work, like, all of this stuff is great, but there's nothing like
when he plays the high school girl too in that series. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, he achieves like some kind of like level of verisimilitude with these characters that I think is pretty unfathomable.
It's realer than reality. like as Werner Herzog says, it's an ecstatic truth. It is more true than what actually is happening in schools. And so I saw that, and all I had was this little USB key that I suppose had been like illegally downloaded and handed to me. And I watched this thing over and over and over again, just thinking, how can one person be so funny?
Yeah, wow. Hey, I'm so glad we started the conversation here, guys, because I think one thing that really sticks out to me with your work, and especially in this new iteration of Nirvana the band, the show, now the movie, is that exact thing you're talking about of acting and using real-life people to expand on plot, delivering expository dialogue to what feels like just real people on the street. Can you talk to me about, I guess, how that has evolved over your creative career and how it specifically works in shaping a feature film's plot?
That's a big answer, because it's like when we were making the web series, I don't know that Jay or I even realized that we were using real people to advance the plot. In fact, if you go back and watch that web series, other than when we're with Ronnie Hawkins or in episode 7, there's a Halloween episode where I will explain problems that we're going through to a group of Spanish tourists who are there. Like, very rarely would we use real people to expose plot. Like, we just we were so young, I don't think we had the sophistication to figure that out. And
but it exposes plot in the sense that, like, we could recognize together when something was so captured, this sort of voyeuristic, like, what a moment of real humanity here. This is very sincere, and we lit up with that. And if it's not expository directly, it is contributing to the narrative because we're showing it, and that is being seen and experienced by Matt and Jay, and it's contributing to their experience in that storyline.
Yes, I would say that another way of saying that is that we were using real people as signifiers to prove that what Jay and I were doing was actually happening. So there was an episode where a car hits me, and I'm pretending to be blind, and we would cut to all the faces of the people. And so we were using them as signposts in a way, as opposed to speaking with real people to try to get information that the characters would then go and move into the next part of the story with. And it's something that we are openly talk about having stolen from Mega 64, but it is the kind of thing that you were forced into in a way, because we didn't know any actors. Like, you just had to do things in the real world. And then it starts to become an essential part of the process. I think midway through shooting The Dirties, when it was like, oh, this is a movie about kids in a high school and I can't cast any actors, period. Like, it's just impossible. And so, because of the comfortability that had been developed making Nirvana the Band, the web series, it was like, well, we'll just go out and wait until we get usable stuff from real people and then have that be the stuff that moves the plot forward. So by the time that we're making the TV series of Nirvana the Band, we're trying to do that every single episode constantly, because I guess in the time between making the web series and making the real show and now making the movie, we realized, oh, that's the thing that makes this unique, is that normally, especially after having made a movie like Blackberry, you realize, oh, real movies just can't do that. It's not that they're complicated. It's just you literally are not allowed to do it. Actually, allowed isn't the right word. It's just physically impossible. The machine of a film set can't effortlessly interact with the real world. It's impossible. And so that dawning on us made it so that we knew every episode of the show and the movie needed to constantly have real people giving us feedback in a way that you would never seen happen in a movie before, unless you're dealing with like art films or super like B movies where it was also happening by necessity.
Jay, I'd love to ask you about the score for this, because, you know, so much of the work that you've done on, I guess, the Nirvana of the series as well is, I guess, evoking certain feelings. Can you talk about, I guess, interpreting the Back to the Future score and kind of making it original to fit into this film?
Well, one of the biggest challenges was the amount of score, because in the television series, I was just basically being told what our legal roadmap was that I needed to just fill in the blanks of. Yep. You're only allowed to use 30 seconds of this, but we need a minute. So I can get strategic about using this 10 seconds and then kind of crossfading it into my instrumental sound alike, crossfading it back, or just short stings here and there. And then a lot of other times we're leaning on fair use and parody law to just use the real thing. In this case, I just got tasked with having to just wall-to-wall score the whole thing. And it was the biggest musical project that I've ever done. But because of that, it was such a gift. I loved it. I wouldn't want it in any other way. It wasn't the plan from the beginning. The plan was we were just going to start chopping up the Back to the Future score. Mm-hmm. But I'm so glad we didn't do that, because when I was scoring this, I realized that there's so much more to this movie than a Back to the Future parody. The Back to the Future thing is a really fun spine that moves us through. And it's certainly fun to evoke that Back to the Future sound, which is also just a sound of 80s big Hollywood movies at the time. But there was so much more to kind of just support from moment to moment and second to second, that it would have been really tough to get the same effect if we were just repurposing on original score. Like the whole last 12 minutes of this movie is a big adventure piece that I got to, you know, it took me, that section took about 3 weeks to do this 12 minutes of just hitting every single action and throwing in all the motifs that we had been building through the whole movie. And it was just an absolute joy to just having looked under the hood of the Silvestri stuff. Some Bernard Herrmann stuff was fun to evoke. And anything else that sort of gave us that feeling where, you know, these guys are in a way imagining that this is a movie and that they're channeling, you know, those feelings that they've had through watching those movies. It's a real Calvin and Hobbes imaginary world that is sort of happening to these guys. And so by the time I found myself deep in the score, I just gave myself this toolkit to dig into. And all I can say is that it was just an absolute joy. It's like my favorite thing.
One thing I want to ask you guys as well before we move on to talk about some Australian films you guys have selected from the video store is, I guess, like this kind of period recreation of your hometown. And I think that that is where so much of the great comedy comes from this film, whether it be like this Jared Fogle ad you see in passing, or I would call it track 4 from the Black Eyed Peas album Elefunk popping up in the soundtrack. Can you talk about, I guess, the joys of getting to actually revisit your city recreating it?
What was fun is that that was sort of when Jay and I first started touring around Toronto, walking around. It was the first time for me anyway that I'd ever been to Yonge and Dundas Square, which is the place where there's the big GTA ad and the Dark Knight poster. So it was beautiful in a way that I don't even know that the audience gets to experience in the same way, other than that they also are seeing it for the first time. So I hadn't thought of it this way, but it wasn't necessarily nostalgia as it was to literally returning to the beginning. Like, we recreated all of these things at the moment when Nirvana the band was kind of created. And it is what it is. It was just beautiful. And every one of those decisions we cherished. It like that Black Eyed Peas song, that exact Subway ad, the exact Grand Theft Auto 4 poster that is up there. Like, these were things that, like, every one of them, we were like, yes, awesome.
It was also, even when the old us are spying on the young us, we're huddled behind a post. And all of the flyers on the post were period rebuilt. And we tried to get as much detail to sort of just periscope into that time as we could. And one of the biggest things, too, which is just a personal psychedelic thing that happened to us, is our old apartment from almost 20 years ago being recreated, where we step into it and it's got all the same shit everywhere. Like, it's like garbage and your cups and the same dumb things that 20-year-olds have on their walls, and the same just stuff just strewn about, an Xbox 360. We sat down in this studio with real daylight lights pouring in, and it was one of the trippiest, it was the closest thing to time travel that I've ever experienced.
It was amazing.
Yeah, I think there's a real great quality in like immersing yourselves in that, but also for me as an Australian watching the movie, there's something in seeing Canada, and which I think is a very similar culture in the way that we kind of have to interpret American culture or UK culture as well through our own. I think seeing all those ads like evoke something quite similar in me as well watching it.
Yeah, there, I say it is us having a kind of permanent younger brother syndrome to America. You guys are much further away, and so I wonder if your commonality is actually with Great Britain, but we have the same thing, which is that I love American media, and it defined my reality and so much of my personality.
It's also that I don't think that we have seen yet in from any movie, I might be wrong, but we're sort of just at the time where we could look back to 2008 and start calling all of that stuff vintage and nostalgic. So I think everyone is kind of being reminded with a bit of a gut punch where it's just like, hey, 2008, that's now considered to be a long time ago.
And it's an identifiable aesthetic now.
Yeah.
On Sunday, the 22nd of February, the world's largest short film festival returns, reclaiming its place as one of Australia's most iconic cultural events. Of course, I am speaking about Tropfest, which for over three decades has been a launch pad for some of the world's most celebrated storytellers and a magnet for audiences who love bold ideas, new voices, and unforgettable nights under the stars. And best of all, Tropfest is entirely free to attend. Come and witness the 16 finalist films have their world premiere on the big screen, judged live by an international jury, with winners announced on the night competing for a share of $100,000 in prizes. I absolutely love Tropfest. I've had many, many great nights there in the past, and truly, I could not be more excited for it to return. And I will say this, many of our guests that have been on the Last Video Store got their start with films over at Tropfest. I think Nash Edgerton, I think Charles Williams, I think many more that I'm not even considering right now. So if you love the Last Video Store, my God, Tropfest is, I dare I say, one of the birthplaces of the Last Video Store. So truly could not be more pumped to get to go to Tropfest once again in my life, and hopefully for many more years. So what I tell you to do is bring a mat, bring your love of film, come to Tropfest on Sunday the 22nd of February at Centennial Park. It's free entry, and if you can't join in person, make sure you tune into the live stream on Tropfest's YouTube channel. Head to tropfest.com for more information and to dive into the extensive archive of past finalists and winners. And follow at Tropfest on socials for updates, announcements, and festival news. Can't wait to see you at Tropfest, baby.
Well, we're part of the show where we talk about some of your favorite movies. I see that you guys have explored a part of the video store that's, you know, an extra room where every genre is an Australian film. And Jay, you've picked up a film. I want to ask you about this one first. Gallipoli is one of your picks. Can you talk to me about Gallipoli?
War.
Sure. I watched it in school, and Mel Gibson has his full Australian accent in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen it in a long time. I just remember its chilling ending when he's trying to stop the wave of soldiers going over this futile push. And ultimately he does push over, and he just goes to his death, spoiler alert. It was a very, very well made and touching film to me as when I was a young boy watching it.
Why do you think it's kind of persisted with you?
It was always interesting that Mel Gibson is so young and so straight up Australian in it. That was interesting one.
It is one of his
It was
rare
one of the first
qualities.
times, yeah, it was one of the first times I'd seen an ending like that where it was where it was a bad ending, where everybody dies in the end, and it just scarred me a little bit. And I've always loved World War I setting stuff. But I haven't seen it in a while, and what this reminded me is by choosing this is I'm going to watch it again.
Oh, good. I'm so glad because I think it's one of those films that, I mean, in Australian cinema, it's known as one of the true classics, but I think it's one of those rare films where, the anti-war film experiment, I think, is a success where it really does make you consider everything. And that's why it's kind of taught in Australian schools as well.
Amazing
Matt.
too that like I just want to say as a
Yeah, of
young
course.
kid who just doesn't really even know how to say, oh, this is a good movie and this is a bad movie. It's amazing that really good movies reach young kids too, where they just inexplicably go, I don't know why, but I'm going to remember this movie for the rest of my life. But I have no idea even how to say why.
Oh man, you unlock something there. That's very astute. Especially
It's
that's a
mad.
film you see very early. We saw it in primary school here in Australia, which is, under the age of 12. And Matt, you've picked up a film that I adore. I haven't seen this film for a really long time either, but
You've
from
seen
the,
it.
of course, from the great Justin
Oh, I'm so happy to
Moorhouse.
hear this.
Yeah, you have picked up Proof.
Drama.
Starring past guest of this show, Hugo Weaving and Russell Crowe, about a blind photographer. Can you tell me about Proof? Because this was a surprise to see you walking around the store with this film.
I could talk about Proof for hours, so we're going to have to be careful. So I'll, for the audience who doesn't know this film, this is like an Australian, it's a forgotten classic in my opinion, and it's a very modest film. So to pitch it super simply, well, okay, first of all, the real headline here is this is Hugo Weaving. Like, it might be his first big performance, and for Russell Crowe it might also be one of his first as well, but it's the story of a blind, self-important photographer who takes pictures of the world and then uses Braille to the title refers to the fact that he'll photograph something, have somebody describe the photo, and then write in Braille that that's what it is. And it's him basically creating proof that the world is what people tell him it is. But that is really not what the movie's about at all. The movie's about male friendship. It's about love. It's about being vulnerable enough to be seen. Hugo Weaving is like playing a kind of asshole curmudgeon who doesn't want to let anybody close to him, but he needs people's help desperately. And it's about a kind of bimbo Russell Crowe, like breaking down his emotional gate and then becoming friends. It's basically a movie about learning how to live. I know this film because I was shown it by my favorite professor in film school. Her name was Teresa Barda, and we would come into class, and sometimes she would just screen movies that I would never have access to. This was my entree to Australian cinema, after which I consumed everything. Every weird movie I know, Walkabout is not like Rogue is not an Australian, but like all of these movies, and it even got me into Jackson, like adjacent, like New Zealand cinema. I watched all of it, but here's what is worth highlighting with this film. The director, I think it's Jocelyn Moorhead, is the last name. I think this was a first feature. Her husband is PJ Hogan, who directed My Best Friend's Wedding, which is easily one of the best American films ever made. And this as a couple, they also made Muriel's Wedding, which is this Australian like a mega comedy hit. Like, it's I mean, you tell me, I assume this is a celebrated film in your
Oh
country.
yeah, there's
You know what I mean?
not
It's
a more
amazing.
beloved film. Yeah, there's a musical based on it that plays on
Of course.
stages.
Look, it's so good. And so, but I didn't realize that, like, because I had seen My Best Friend's Wedding and loved it. And then once you get in your head, oh, wait a minute, this is a kind of Australian cynicism that Julia Roberts is playing in the movie, and like the way they view relationships, romantic, the chase, all this stuff. I was like, Oh, Australia, like the reason I'm so attracted to Australian cinema is because the worldview it presents is something that I find deeply true. And so like really great Australian dramas, comedies, whatever they are, I think present the world that I want to live in. And so Proof is to me one of those life-affirming, both hilarious and deeply moving movies. Changed my life, and I still think of it often, even though it is you never hear about it. Like it's I don't even know what the director went on to do afterwards. But
I
anyway,
wasn't a big fan myself.
of Proof. Yeah, you'd love it.
I
You'd love it,
really,
Jake.
now I
You really
think
do
you would
want
love
to.
it. It's got a really great score
So
by Not Drowning Waving, which as well, like, really
the music is
like this
beautiful.
character. Yeah.
Oh,
And do you
lovely.
know who we're talking about? Do you know who Hugo Weaving is, Bert?
Hugo Weaving? Oh yeah.
Yeah, so this
Mr.
is, so you
Anderson.
get to see him. You get to see
I was
Agent
there
Smith.
4,000 years ago.
Yeah, so it's basically
Or
Agent
3,000.
Smith against Gladiator, and
In an
it's, I
intimate
mean,
drama.
oh, it's there's a scene where Hugo Weaving, because of course he's blind, is. He's in a car with Russell Crowe, and Russell Crowe goes, "So have you ever driven a car before?" And Hugo was, "Of course not." He's like, "Do you want to try?" And so Russell Crowe puts Hugo Weaving behind the wheel of the car. They drive. A blind guy is driving the car. They crash, I think, into a police car. Go to jail. The cop is like checking the guy's eyes, and he's like, "You're driving? Don't you know that you're blind?" And Hugo Weaving goes, "Yeah, I forgot." Like, I forgot I was blind, and I get away
I
with it.
gotta
Look,
see
it's
Hugo Weaving in that role. That
you
sounds
got it.
so like fresh.
He stops Guy Pearce in the head and says, "Get out of here. You don't get your career. I want it." And then Guy Pearce winds up taking it away from him.
Hey guys, before we
Alex,
wrap
I'm
up.
impressed that you know Proof, and thank you so
Oh,
much for
mate.
giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
My
It's a film
pleasure.
that
My
deserves to
pleasure.
be seen.
You're welcome to talk about it anytime. Before we wrap up, usually I give a recommendation of a film I think that our guests will enjoy. And I want to kind of keep the Australian thing going. I want to recommend you guys, have you ever seen or heard of the film Bad Boy Bubby?
Cult.
Never in my life. I'll write it down.
Well, I'll give you a quick rundown because I think it is a real sicko film that starts in this place of darkness that as the film continues, it grows in this empathetic beauty to become something truly astounding and ascendant. It's from Australian filmmaker Rolf Dahir, and it's kind of that rare example of an experimental film where every experiment or element of the experiment is a wild success. It's about this man who starts his life trapped in this little hole home with his mother, thinking the world outside is like a desolate wasteland. And then one day he escapes and realizes, oh, the world is just normal out there. And you kind of go on this journey of someone, I guess, discovering empathy. And the way that it's made, I think, for people such as yourselves that devour film, the experiments are all about like placing you in the character. Like all the sound is recorded binaurally on microphones taped to the back of the actor's ears, so you hear the world through
Cool.
his ears. And every single scene is shot by a different cinematographer. So every time you keep moving with this character, you're seeing the world in a new way. And really, it's a very, very special film.
Cool.
It won like an ecumenical award at, I think, Venice Film Festival, one of the big film festivals. And when you see the movie the way it starts, you can't believe that it would go and take you on this journey. But I think a really special film and like the ultimate cult Australian film as well.
I will check it out immediately. I'm surprised I've never heard of this. Thank you.
It's
We'll
called
watch it
Bad Boy
together.
Bubby. Please, please. And report back to me. Report back to me if
We
you
will.
after you
When we
see it.
come to Australia, we'll come see you in person. And a note from us, just a personal thanks on Australian film has meant so much to us. We're jealous. I wish Canada had one tenth of the output that your country has had. It's a miracle. I consider it the strongest artistic voice in the Commonwealth by far. Rivaled, I mean, only by the UK itself. Like, it's unbelievable what your country's been able to do in terms of moving both cinema and television forward. It's, I'm jealous.
Wow, that genuinely means a lot because it's my mission to kind of help people fall in love with Australian film. So yowza, thank you so much for that endorsement. I'll put it on the map somewhere.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate it. Love the movie. Really love your work. Thanks for your generosity with your time as well. And hopefully, when you're in Australia, keep me up.
We will.
We'll see you.
The Last Video Store.
So that was my chat with the stars, creators, director, and composer of Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll, two heroes of mine. What a great chat that was. Honestly, tear to my eye just listening back to Maddie talk about the power and love of Australian film. That is so special. My thanks to our friends at Madman Films for getting us in contact and getting them on the show. And also, genuinely, huge thanks to them for being so generous with their time. We got a really good slot on a junket to have them all in. So thank you so much, guys. And thank you for tuning into this episode. Go see Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie in cinemas this weekend, and keep your eyes peeled for an online VOD release. Hopefully a good Blu-ray as well. I'm crossing my fingers for a good freaking Blu-ray of this movie. You guys got to put a good Blu-ray together. Think about all the special features. You could put the podcast as one of the special features. I'll offer it right now. That'd be awesome. But love this movie. Come see my show VHS at all the comedy festivals. Links to it in the show notes. Until next time, I'll see you at the movies, baby. Love you very much. Movies. Movies. This episode of The Last Video Store was brought to you by Tropfest. It's happening on the 22nd of February at Centennial Park. I'll be there. You will too, dude.